Chapter 4. Before them, in which some green plants or hollyhocks are growing, and to each house is a gate, that has mostly a picture or queer carved ornament upon or about it, and bears the name, not of the Bedouin who inhabits it, but of the saint to whom she may have devoted it, the house of Saint Stephen, the house of Saint Donatus, the English or Angel Convent, and so on. Old ladies in black are pacing in the quiet alleys here and there, and drop the stranger a curtsy as he passes them, and takes off his hat. Never were such patterns of neatness seen as these old ladies and their houses. I peeped into one or two of the chambers, of which the windows were open to the pleasant evening sun, and saw beds scrupulously plain, a quaint old chair or two, and little pictures of favorite saints decorating the spotless white walls. The old ladies kept up a quick, cheerful clatter, as they paused to gossip at the gates of their little domiciles, and with a great deal of artifice, and lurking behind walls, and looking at the church, as if I intended to design that, I managed to get a sketch of a couple of them. But what white paper can render the whiteness of their linen, what black ink can do justice to the luster of their gowns and shoes? Both of the ladies had a neat ankle and a tight stocking, and I fancy that heaven is quite as well served in this costume as in the dress of a scowling, stockingless friar, whom I had seen passing just before. The look and dress of the man made me shudder. His great red feet were bound up in a shoe open at the toes, a kind of compromise for a sandal. I had just seen him, and his brethren at the Dominican church, where a mass of music was sung, and orange trees, flags, and banners decked the aisle of the church. One begins to grow sick of these churches, and the hideous exhibitions of bodily agonies that are depicted on the sides of all the chapels. Into one wherein we went this morning was what they called a Calvary. A horrible ghastly image of a Christ in a tomb, the figure of the natural size, and of the livid color of death, gaping red wounds on the body and round the brows. The whole piece enough to turn one sick, and fit only to brutalize the beholder of it. The Virgin is commonly represented with a dozen swords stuck in her heart. Bleeding throats of headless John Baptists are perpetually thrust before your eyes. At the cathedral gate was a papier match church ornament shop, most of the carvings and reliefs of the same dismal character. One, for instance, represented a heart with a great gash in it, and a double row of large blood drops dribbling from it. Nails and a knife were thrust into the heart. Round the whole was a crown of thorns. Such things are dreadful to think of. The same gloomy spirit which made a religion of them, and worked upon the people by the grossest of all means, terror, distracted the natural feelings of man, to maintain its power shut gentle women in two lonely pitiless convents, frightened poor peasants with tales of torment, taught that the end and labor of life was silence, wretchedness, and the scourge murdered those by faggot and prison who thought otherwise. How has the blind and furious bigotry of man perverted that which God gave us as our greatest boon, and bid us hate, where God bade us love? Thank heaven that monk has gone out of sight. It is pleasant to look at the smiling, cheerful old Bedouin, and think no more of yonder livid face. One of the many convents in this little religious city seems to be the specimen house, which is shown to strangers. For all the guides conduct you thither, and I saw in a book kept for the purpose the names of innumerable Smiths and Geneses registered. A very kind, sweet-voiced, smiling nun, I wonder, do they always choose the most agreeable and best-humored sister of the house to show it to strangers? Came tripping down the steps, and across the flags of the little garden court, and welcomed us with much courtesy into the neat little old-fashioned, red-bricked, gable-ended, shining-windowed convent of the angels. First she showed us a whitewashed parlor, decorated with a grim picture or two, and some crucifixes and other religious emblems, where, upon stiff old chairs, the sisters sit and work. Three or four of them were still there, pattering over their laces and bobbins, but the chief part of the sisterhood were engaged in an apartment hard by, from which issued a certain odor which I must say resembled onions. It was in fact the kitchen of the establishment. Every Bedouin cooks her own little dinner in her own little pipkin, and there was half a score of them, sure enough, busy over their pots and crockery, cooking a repast which, when ready, was carried off to a neighboring room, the refectory, where, at a ledge table which is drawn out from under her own particular cupboard, each nun sits down and eats her meal in silence. More religious emblems ornamented the carved cupboard doors, and within, everything was as neat could be. Shining pewter ewers and glasses, snug baskets of eggs and pats of butter, and little bowls with about a farthing's worth of green tea, in them for some great day of fate, doubtless. The old lady sat round as we examined these things, each eating soberly at her ledge, and never looking round. There was a bell ringing in the chapel hard by. "Ark," said our guide, "that is one of the sisters dying. Will you come up and see the cells?" The cells, it need not be said, are the snuggest little nests in the world, with serge curtain beds and snowy linen, and saints and martyrs pinned against the wall. "E may sit up till 12 o'clock, if we like," said the nun, "but we have no fire and candle, and so what's the use of sitting up? When we have said our prayers we are glad enough to go to sleep." I forget, although the good soul told us, how many times in the day, in public and in private, these devotions are made, but fancy that the morning service in the chapel takes place at too early an hour for most easy travelers. We did not fail to attend in the evening, when likewise is a general muster of the 700, minus the absent and sick, and the sight is not a little curious and striking to a stranger. The chapel is a very big whitewashed place of worship, supported by half a dozen columns on either side, over each of which stands the statue of an apostle, with his emblem of martyrdom. Nobody was as yet at the distant altar, which was too far off to see very distinctly, but I could perceive two statues over it, one of which, St. Lawrence, no doubt, was leaning upon a huge gilt gridiron, that the sun lighted up in a blaze a painful, but not a romantic instrument of death. A couple of old ladies in white hoods were tugging, and swaying about at two bell ropes that came down into the middle of the church, and at least 500 others in white veils were seated all round about us in mute contemplation until the service began, looking very solemn, and white, and ghastly, like an army of tombstones by moonlight. The service commenced as the clock finished striking 7. The organ pealed out, a very cracked and old one, and presently some weak old voice from the choir overhead quavered out a canticle, which done, a thin old voice of a priest at the altar far off, and which had now become quite gloomy in the sunset, chanted feebly another part of the service. Then the nuns warbled once more overhead. And it was curious to hear, in the intervals of the most lugubrious chants, how the organ went off with some extremely cheerful military or profane air. At one time was a march, at another a quick tune, which ceasing, the old nuns began again, and so sung until the service was ended. In the midst of it one of the white-veiled sisters approached us with a very mysterious air, and put down her white veil close to our ears and whispered. Were we doing anything wrong, I wondered? Were they come to that part of the service, where heretics and infidels ought to quit the church? What have you to ask, O sacred, white-veiled maid? All she said was, "Du centimes pour les sous," which sum was paid, and presently the old ladies, rising from their chairs one by one, came in face of the altar, where they knelt down, and said a short prayer. Then, rising, unpinned their veils, and folded them up all exactly in the same folds and fashion, and laid them square like napkins on their heads, and tucked up their long black outer dresses, and trudged off to their convents. The novices wear black veils, under one of which I saw a young, sad, handsome face. It was the only thing in the establishment that was the least romantic or gloomy. And, for the sake of any reader of a sentimental turn, let us hope that the poor soul has been crossed in love, and that over some soul-stirring tragedy that black curtain has fallen. Ghent has, I believe, been called a vulgar Venice. It contains dirty canals and old houses that must satisfy the most eager antiquary, though the buildings are not quite in so good preservation as others that may be seen in the Netherlands. The commercial bustle of the place seems considerable, and it contains more beer shops than any city I ever saw. These beer shops seem the only amusement of the inhabitants, until, at least, the theater shall be built, of which the elevation is now complete, a very handsome and extensive pile. There are beer shops in the cellars of the houses, which are frequented, it is to be presumed, by the lower sort. There are beer shops at the barriers, where the citizens and their families repair, and beer shops in the town, glaring with gas, with long gauze blinds, however, to hide what I hear, is a rather questionable reputation. Arin, the Adel of the Post, a spacious and comfortable residence, is on a little place planted round with trees, and that seems to be the palace royal of the town. Three clubs, which look from without to be very comfortable, ornament this square with their gas lamps. Here stands, too, the theater that is to be. There is a café, and on evenings a military band plays the very worst music I ever remember to have heard. I went out tonight to take a quiet walk upon this place, and the horrid brazen discord of these trumpeters set me half mad. I went to the café for refuge, passing on the way a subterraneous beer shop, where men and women were drinking to the sweet music of a cracked barrel organ. They take in a couple of French papers at this café, and the same number of Belgian journals. You may imagine how well the latter are informed, when you hear that the Battle of Bouillon, fought by the immortal Louis Napoleon, was not known here until some gentleman out of Norfolk brought the news from London, and until it had traveled to Paris, and from Paris to Brussels. For a whole hour I could not get a newspaper at the café. The horrible brass band in the meantime had quitted the place, and now, to amuse the Ghent citizens, a couple of little boys came to the café and set up a small concert. One played ill on the guitar, but sang, very sweetly, plaintive French ballads. The other was the comic singer. He carried about with him a queer, long, damp-looking, moldy white hat, with no brim. "Coudes," said the waiter to me, "il va faire l'anglais. Qu'est très drôle." The little rogue mounted his immense brimless hat, and, thrusting his thumbs into the armholes of his waistcoat, began to faire l'anglais, with a song in which swearing was the principal joke. We all laughed at this, and indeed the little rascal seemed to have a good deal of humor. How they hate us, these foreigners, in Belgium as much as in France. What lies they tell of us, how gladly they would see us humiliated. Honest folks at home over their port wine say, eh, and very good reason they have to. National vanity, sir, wounded we have beaten them so often. My dear sir, there is not a greater error in the world than this. They hate you, because you are stupid, hard to please, and intolerably insolent and air-giving. I walked with an Englishman yesterday, who asked the way to a street, of which he pronounced the name very badly to a little Flemish boy. The Flemish boy did not answer, and there was my Englishman quite in a rage, shrieking in the child's ear, as if he must answer. He seemed to think that it was the duty of the snob, as he called him, to obey the gentleman. This is why we are hated for pride. In our free country a tradesman, a lackey, or a waiter will submit to almost any given insult from a gentleman. In these benighted lands one man is as good as another, and pray God it may soon be so with us. Of all European people, which is the nation that has the most haughtiness, the strongest prejudices, the greatest reserve, the greatest dullness? I say an Englishman of the genteel classes. An honest groom jokes and hops and nobs and makes his way with the kitchen maids, for there is good social nature in the man. His master dare not unbend. Look at him, how he scowls at you on your entering an inn room. Think how you scowl yourself to meet his scowl. Today, as we were walking and staring about the place, a worthy old gentleman in a carriage, seeing a pair of strangers, took off his hat and bowed very gravely with his old powdered head out of the window. I am sorry to say that our first impulse was to burst out laughing. It seemed so supremely ridiculous that a stranger should notice and welcome another. As for the notion that foreigners hate us because we have beaten them so often, my dear sir, this is the greatest error in the world. Well-educated Frenchmen do not believe that we have beaten them. A man was once ready to call me out in Paris because I said that we had beaten the French in Spain, and here before me is a French paper with a London correspondent discoursing about Louis Buonaparte and his jackass expedition to Bowlen. He was received at Eglinton, it is true, says the correspondent, but what do you think was the reason? Because the English nobility were anxious to revenge upon his person with some coups de lance the checks which the Grand Homme his uncle had inflicted on us in Spain. This opinion is so general among the French that they would laugh at you with scornful incredulity if you ventured to assert any other. Foy's history of the Spanish War does not, unluckily, go far enough. I have read a French history which hardly mentions the war in Spain and calls the Battle of Salamanca a French victory. You know how the other day, and in the teeth of all evidence, the French swore to their victory of Toulouse. And so it is with the rest, and you may set it down as pretty certain, first, that only a few people know the real state of things in France as to the matter in dispute between us, second, that those who do keep the truth to themselves, and so it is as if it had never been. These Belgians have caught up, and quite naturally, the French tone. We are perfect Albion with them still. Here is the Ghent paper, which declares that it is beyond a doubt that Louis Napoleon was sent by the English and Lord Palmerston. And though it states in another part of the journal from English authority that the prince had never seen Lord Palmerston, yet the lie will remain uppermost the people, and the editor will believe it to the end of time. See to what a digression yonder little fellow in the tall hat has given rise. Let us make his picture, and have done with him. I could not understand, in my walks about this place, which is certainly picturesque enough, and contains extraordinary charms in the shape of old gables, quaint spires, and broad shining canals, I could not at first comprehend why, for all this, the town was especially disagreeable to me, and have only just hit on the reason why. Sweetest Juliana, you will never guess it. It is simply this, that I have not seen a single decent-looking woman in the whole place. They look all ugly, with coarse mouths, vulgar figures, mean mercantile faces, and so the traveler walking among them finds the pleasure of his walk excessively damped, and the impressions made upon him disagreeable. In the academy there are no pictures of merit, but sometimes a second-rate picture is as pleasing as the best, and one may pass an hour here very pleasantly. There is a room appropriated to Belgian artists, of which I never saw the like. They are, like all the rest of the things in this country, miserable imitations of the French school great nude Venuses, and Junos a la David, with the drawing left out. Bruges. The change from vulgar Ghent, with its ugly women and coarse bustle, to this quiet, old, half-deserted, cleanly Bruges, was very pleasant. I have seen old men at Versailles, with shabby coats and pigtails, sunning themselves on the benches in the walls. They had seen better days, to be sure, but they were gentlemen still. And so we found, this morning, old Dowager Bruges basking in the pleasant August sun, and looking if not prosperous, at least cheerful and... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.